while she's doing that, I will introduce her. This is Madeline Dietrich, and Madeline has worked as a professional musician and music educator for 30 years, specializing in stringed instruments. She received her Bachelor of Music from the University of North Texas, her Master of Music in Performance from Texas Christian University, and her Master of Music in Musicology and Master of Library and Information Science from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Kind of a masterful resume. Madeline is primarily a jazz bassist, but also enjoys hacking away at the fiddle and mandolin. She recently began her career in music librarianship and holds the position of dean, is that right? Dean? Dean Composer's Room Supervisor at Old Dominion University in Norfolk. She's going to be presenting a case study entitled Western Swing and the Examination of an Information Object, a Research Model.
I was thinking there might be more like students. It's kind of partly the audience, but so some of this stuff, a lot of things in this presentation you already know. And and then you'll also notice if you picked up if you picked up one of my handouts, I put a little survey on the front of it. This is my first professional presentation, and I would love your feedback about anything, and just email me. Like when you go to a Chinese buffet and you get a to-go box and you stuff it with as much as you can fit into that styrofoam box. And that's what I did with this presentation. And I'm gonna try to remember my password. Yeah. And some of that Chinese food is overdone. Some of it's underdone. And some of it stinks. So what do I do at this point? The whole reason I got into Western swing, I was an orchestra teacher, I was a strings teacher, but I also played gigs. I hung out in North Texas and down in Houston and Galveston, and worked as a bass player. And anytime I brought up Western swing to the people I was playing with, horn players, they never heard of it. And they sure never heard of any of the musicians. And I was thinking, why not? Well, because they don't teach anything about it in the jazz history canon and academia. So that kind of gave me a chip on my shoulder. And that is the basis for this as well. So I'm going to rifle through a lot of these. Basically, we're taking a single object, a single 78 record, and we're seeing what evidence can be employed to understand an object and different approaches. Okay, so my assertion, Western swing is jazz. So let's listen to some Western swing. We're going to compare that with jazz. So here's some jazz. We'll be right back. Okay, so what do you think? Is it jazz? Well, we need to, if we're going to state our opinion, we need to prepare to do it for a company of people that know their stuff. I put academic audience, but I consider the audience here among the world's experts in this subject. Okay, so you do a literature review, find out what's been written, familiarize yourself with current and past discussions. What are the authorities? Identify the authorities. If we say Western swing is jazz, then we got to think, what do the authorities consider jazz? What does this word really mean? The Grove Dictionary says it's a tradition, a music tradition. It's a creative process involving improvisation, and it's a style of music, syncopation, and these other things. Writers often portray jazz as a narrative progress, but tracing lines of evolution and innovation reveals only part of a story much broader in scope. As an object of study, jazz is a volatile subject. Its identity can't be isolated or delimited. It refers to an extended family of genres. Varying functions of jazz have made it difficult to perceive as a unified entity, and the subject of race has generated heated debate. So invoking the word jazz leads to many possible paths of discussion, and for my purpose, we need to narrow it down. So we go back and look for some more information about these things. One authority we can conduct is the Library of Congress authority headings. They're the ones that decide what everything gets classified as. They put words that describe what this stuff is. And in this is the subject authority heading for the word jazz. And I don't think you can see it very well, but under it shows 10 narrower terms under the broad heading of jazz, and it includes swing music, and it includes Western swing, which I was delighted to see, because so that means there's some acknowledged relationship. Here is their authority record for Western swing, and we can see that it's a subheading for country music and jazz. So I was kind of happy to see that. Another authority, the Grove Dictionary that we mentioned earlier when we defined jazz, what is swing? A quality attributed to a jazz performance. It's the name given to a jazz style. What is Western swing? A hybrid form of American country music incorporating jazz. So, swing is a quality of jazz and a style of jazz. It's jazz. Western swing is merely country music that incorporates jazz. We can further narrow our focus to the 20s and 30s and hot jazz, a term used to describe early jazz, qualities of excitement, passion, and intensity. And then from Carey's wonderful discography, regarding Western swing bands, those that displayed swing tendencies or those that showed a linear development and growth from a traditional Western or string band into a hot jazz-oriented group. The term Western swing wasn't used until the early 40s. Music we'll be talking about is mostly from the 30s. So as we compare hot jazz and hot string band music, keep in mind improvisation, the use of syncopation, that it draws on blues a lot, the cyclical form of the music, and the element of swing. So here is some examples of what is described with labels jazz. It says, the authority says, this is jazz, so.
Yeah, man, there's Brunner.
Looking for that lost love of mine.
I I specifically put Joe Venuti in there. He's the one of two violinists that most jazz people have ever heard of, the other being Stefan Grappelli. They never have heard of Stuff Smith, who... yes, I mean, there's a lot of them. And the violinist we'll be looking at, Cecil Brower, is said to have been highly influenced by Joe Venuti, and I think you'll agree when we look at that. Here's some examples of what would be later termed Western swing, and none of the Library of Congress bibliographic records, or I should say the OCLC records that I uncovered for these things, the word jazz was never in the subject description. Other it was Western swing, country music, honky-tonk music, and string band. Comparisons. If we're comparing two different kinds of music, we need to find examples that share traits that are similar to give us a basis of comparison, and then we can identify what the differences are. And so we're looking at how the different bands may have arranged a tune, what's the instrumentation in the ensembles, how did the ensemble interact with one another, and the individual solos, the jazz improvisation involved. So common traits, more specifically, if I'm going to choose, for comparison, do I want to find two pieces that have the same form? Do I want to have two bands playing the same song? Or do I want to listen to solos that have essentially the same chord changes, like rhythm changes or something? So how many examples are necessary for an effective comparison? I don't know. Select something that you acknowledge by the experts as being an example of whatever it is that you're discussing. I identified a known performer of hot string band music, Milton Brown, and his musical brownies. From this performance repertory of this guy, I selected a song I already knew ahead of time was considered a jazz standard, Who's Sorry Now? So we look, and now we've selected an information object, and this is a Decca record released in 1935. The content and the carrier, the content is the audio data that's stored in the grooves, and the carrier is the vinyl disc itself. So the carrier is a visual, something we can inspect visually. So we look at the label. What's on the label? Record company, the title, performers. Description here says string band with singing. It's a single object created by multiple contributors, entities that were already in existence. It documents the 3 minutes when these entities occupied the same time and space in the recording studio. It's a document of a 3-minute encounter that is unique and will never happen again. And so here's my little diagram of that. And when I gave this talk the other day, somebody objected, well, you've got this on a Cartesian plane, and it's okay to you can see what the x-axis is, but I don't understand what the y-axis is. Well, the y-axis has no significance. This is a fanciful rendering. So, you know, the arced arrows just show the trajectory of objects. That's, you know, I didn't think anybody was going to ask. Of course somebody asked. What is this object and why does it exist? It was created as a commodity. It was a promotional tool. And they wanted to, the Brownies wanted to spread their audience base. And Decca wanted to sell records. It became a historical artifact, a document of regional taste in popular dance music at a given time in history. Depression era, Fort Worth, Dallas area. So let's look at these different contributing entities. The record company, American Decca, Jack Capp, and started it in 1934. By 1938, it was the second biggest company. Decca recorded Bing Crosby, the Mills Brothers, Al Jolson, lots of big names. His brother Dave Capp was hired to put together the Hillbilly catalog, and so Dave Capp went out and scouted for talent. So that's the record company. Here's the other one of the other contributors, the band, Milton Brown. Milton Brown was a singer through the 20s, trained in high school, but sang professionally popular music, not necessarily country music. In 1930, he formed a trio with Bob Wills and Herman Arnsperger. Did I say that right? Thank you. In 1932, Milton Brown started a band called the Musical Brownies with piano, bass, rhythm guitar, tenor banjo. So they had a rhythm section resembling New Orleans and Chicago groups of the 20s and 30s. There's no drummer. That's the big difference. They didn't need one. Brownies played dance music based in Fort Worth, Texas, and you can read the rest of that as we listen to examples that are not jazz. They're not really Western swing. So the Brownies were essentially a top 40 band, I think.
Beautiful, beautiful Texas, where the beautiful blue bonnets grow. You're bound to look like a monkey when you grow old. When you grow old.
When you grow old.
When you grow old.
When you grow old.
When you grow old.
I'm here and tell me, baby, whose muddy shoes are these? I'm here and Lord, I love that gal like a tube I love it mine.
And then listening to all these examples back to back also gives you just kind of an overall sound. You can hear the similarities, the sound of the Brownies, the band's sound. When Decca brought the Brownies up to Chicago in January of 1935, both Decca and the Brownies shared a space for 2 days. They cut 36 sides. Each recording documents the intersection of Decca and the Brownies with a previously existing work. So here's another fanciful diagram of this where two entities are coexisting and then they're intersecting with these the songs that they played. Each one of those had an origin at some other time, and for 2 or 3 minutes they existed together and produced a new object which has its own trajectory that lasts till today. And then the third thing, we talked about the band, we talked about the record company. The song in this case was Who's Sorry Now? And in order to look at the Brownies' performance of this song, we really need to take a close look at the song. Here is some melodic and text analysis that I did. I wrote another paper on this, and so I had plenty to kind of cram in there. But, you know, get to know the song. What is it about the song that is not part of the performance? So here is the song, Who's Sorry Now, published in 1923. It exists as various objects. It manifests as piano rolls, sheet music, and it exists as a concept, just the idea of the song. So here's how the music was written and what it sounded like in 1923.
And you're crying now while I am just learning to
waltz. The sheet music has a foxtrot variation on the last page. Here are some other versions that also came out in 1923. So this is all contributing to the overall concept of the tune that everybody holds. And the Brownies probably had heard some of these other recordings that came out after 1923, but before
1935. Who's sorry now? Who's sorry now? Whose heart is aching for breaking each vow?
So the song, as a concept, I've prepared an illustration that helps us to distinguish the song from the performance of the song. Let's see if I can make this go over there. The work itself, the Who's Sorry Now, the song, and the concept of the work that is held by the general public, everybody, how they understand that concept. This represents the band. This represents the performance that ended up being recorded. That's the manifestation. That is the expression of the work. That's the expression of the work. If you record it, it manifests as an object. So the audience listens to it and compares it with their memory of the tune. The band comes to the recording studio with a preconceived idea of what Who's Sorry Now is. As we listen to a little bit of this, think about elements of jazz, groove, harmonic language, ensemble makeup, solo and group improv. Oops, I want to go back. You an idea. Oral content can only be experienced in real time, complicating efforts to discuss the music. How can we facilitate a discussion without necessarily listening to it, which isn't always possible, by transcribing the music, illustrating and indexing an ephemeral phenomenon by taking it out of the context of time. It provides organization for visual analysis. Your visual centers think differently than your oral centers do. It creates access to information that might enable catalogers and historians to more accurately describe the audio content. Creates access for musicians who rely on reading sheet music because they don't know how to play by ear. And if you're encoding this music into some kind of format like music XML, you got all this data that can be used for some algorithm that could do some automatic analysis, like those people did of the dominant seventh chord or whatever it was that I don't remember that article that came out. The presence of the dominant seventh chord in rock and roll over the last 40 years. So when you do a transcription, how precise do you need to be? The granularity, do I want to reduce to the lowest eighth note, lowest 16th note, lowest 32nd? Two kinds of notation: descriptive notation, which describes it, and prescriptive notation, which is instructions for musicians. And here is what the first page of the what it looks like, and you can follow it. So, how much detail is enough? How much is too much? How much information do the musicians need? Here's an extracted violin part. And so a lot of violinists are classically trained. So that's what that looks like. Here's the steel guitar part. And I read up on this, and I actually went and took a lesson from a guy in Chicago who I had transcribed the solo or learn it by ear. And then he showed me how he thought Bob Dunn probably played it. And so I based it on that. I learned what tuning Bob Dunn was probably using at that time. And it made very good sense when you try to play it. But notice I put tablature because steel guitars are not trained in the conservatory. And most of them rely on, if they read at all, they're going to look at tablature. So I don't know what that's all about. Oh, yeah. Okay, so we can use the transcription to compare different solos of the Brownies members versus soloists from other recordings of this same song. So here is five different people playing the first four measures of the form, and we can compare and look at the similarities and differences. This is Benny Goodman. Red Allen. Cecil Brown. Bob Dunn. Miff Moore. Okay, and another possible comparison we could make using this data that we've collected by transcribing, Bob Dunn is said to have had considerable knowledge of the trombone and was influenced by brass playing. So let's compare his solo to the two brass players, Red Allen and Miff Mole, and we'll listen to that. Similar. So when we compare orally, we're comparing what we're hearing with our memory of what we heard earlier. Visually, we can compare it almost immediately, side by side. However, for fun, because I know you guys would want to hear this, I mixed it together. And this is not as useful as a study tool. Okay, so let's look at the whole transcription. I made a little film, and see if we can make this come up. It's about 3.5 minutes.
Sorry now, who's sorry now, whose heart is aching for breaking each vow, who's sad and blue, who's crying too, just like I cried over you. tried to the end, sweetheart and friend, I tried to warn you somehow. Now you've had your way, now you must pay. I'm glad that you're sorry now.
Okay, so let's draw some conclusions and ask new questions. In 1935, the words used to describe this music were intended to sell the music. Hillbilly. Okay. Brian Rust, in the 70s, published two discographies. How did he decide which records should go in which discography? So the ones that went into the jazz records, ragtime, jazz, swing idioms, including also a number of dance records described as hot. American Dance Band discography was records of dance bands from the sweet romantic styles of Guy Lombardo and Wayne King to the vivacious swing of the Dorseys. Milton Brown and the Western Swing Bands were included in neither book, not acknowledged at all. Is it appropriate now to place Western Swing on the radar of those who wish to study jazz history? Who is credited with the creation of the content? Okay, so this goes into a slightly different tangent. Considering the improvised solos, there are some people that would argue because of the intellectual content, it's not necessarily an expression of the work, an arrangement, but it's actually new. It's a new work in and of itself, which would apply to every Charlie Parker solo and every Thelonious Monk solo. How would you catalog that? Crazy idea. There's some tools in the works that are meant to exploit new technology. Ferber uses the words that the concept we looked at earlier, work versus expression of the work versus manifestation of the work, which is the original album, and then the item, which is the reproduced one. So anytime you're holding it, you're holding an item that is one of everyone that was printed. So that's what that is. How can we use this data to make bibliographic records more accurate in connecting these recordings with the people who really did contribute to them? And they've got a new thing called the Bibliographic Framework Initiative, and it uses linked data. And real quickly, what linked data does is right now, when you go onto Wikipedia or anything and you press a hyperlink, you press text, it takes you to that new page. But the page you're on doesn't know what page you're going to go to. Well, it does because it's got the hyperlink embedded, but when you get to the new page, it doesn't know where you came from. What linked data is doing is when you get to the new page, it knows where you came from and therefore has more information about what it is you're trying to accomplish. So it's more, much more powerful way to relate entities. So final, if it is jazz, why isn't it more widely acknowledged as such? Associated iconography, I was like, cowboys? No, they're not jazzers. Political, cultural associations of the music, and non-jazz music association, because there's a lot of the music wasn't jazz for sure. So anyway, that wraps it up. Thank you very much. Yep.